Good day, and welcome to today's Patient Safety Measures Steering Committee conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. For today's opening remarks and introductions, I would like to turn the call over to Ms. Elisa Muntali and Mr. Andrew Liesinga. Please go ahead. And pardon the interruption. It appears that Ms. Muntali's line has been disconnected for just a moment. Does someone want to take over the conference until she rejoins?
Yes, thank you, operator. This is Lisa Thiemann, co-chair of the Patient Safety Measures Steering Committee. Dr. Conway, would you like to introduce yourself?
And I'm Bill Conway, the other co-chair.
Terrific. And while we are waiting for Elisa and Andrew to rejoin, I think everyone should have the agenda in front of them as to what we are intending to do here. There are public members on the line as well, and we are reconsidering Patient Safety Measure 044, Radiation Dose Computed CT, or CT, University of California, San Francisco. That was submitted by Dr. Rebecca Smith-Binman. And so we will get to that once Elisa and Andrew rejoin. I think that they did want to say a few moments, take a few moments and just bring the steering committee up to date on where we were on the overall scope of the project. So at this point, I think we probably can't move forward until Elisa and Andrew are online.
Hi, Lisa. Sorry about that. We got disconnected, as I think you know.
Yes, thank you. Elisa, Bill and I have just introduced ourselves and welcomed everybody to the call. And just briefly said we're going to be reconsidering PSM 044 as submitted by Dr. Smith-Binman.
Excellent. Thank you.
So I'll turn it back to you and Andrew for a recap.
Okay.
Well, that pretty much covers it. We'd just reiterate your welcome to the committee and say thanks again for joining us on such short notice and taking time out of your busy schedules to do this call with us. We really appreciate your time. And with that, I guess Lisa, you've already given the committee a bit of background again on why we're having this call. To reiterate again, we're following up on the February 22nd conference call, which was to review the public comments on the second draft report. During that call, the committee decided to remove its endorsement of PSM 04410, and we have gotten some request from the measure developer to reconsider that measure so she can present some additional information to the committee. So with that, I'll just give it back to you, Lisa, and we can resume the call. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Andrew. Operator, I do believe we have Dr. Rebecca Smith-Binman on the line. And at this point, Dr. Smith-Binman, the steering committee would like to welcome you to present a few moments of overview concerning PSM 044. It's my understanding that you had received the comments or at least the audio portion of the previous steering committee's discussions on the measure, and we would welcome you to share some additional information. I know many of us have had written documents from you, but please feel free to join the call and share your perspectives on this.
Fantastic. Andrew, could you load the PowerPoint slides that I created?
Yep, we'll pull them up right now.
Fantastic. So I would just like to thank the committee for giving me the chance to sort of share a little bit more information. The sense that I had in reading some of the comments and listening to some of the discussion were that there were basically five issues that it was worth highlighting to you. And so in the summary that I sent you, I provided way more detail than I'm sure you wanted on those topics. And in this PowerPoint, I was just going to go through them very quickly, issues that I think are really important to consider with this measure. For some of them, we generated quite the number of new graphs just to highlight some associations.
Dr. Smith-Binman,
yes.
This is Lisa. I'm sorry. I have to interrupt you for just a second. Andrew, I think the screen share from the URL has not gone through.
Yeah, it seems to be a little bit slow in loading. We're waiting for it to come up at the moment.
Okay. Rebecca, the entire steering committee did receive a copy of your slide deck. So I think we're probably fine to go ahead and move forward. People, the steering committee members can follow along individually until the screen loads.
Okay, so you got the PowerPoint slides?
Yes. The committee.
Okay, fantastic.
And so, I'm Steve Lawless. I just arrived, so I'm sorry I'm late.
Okay. So I'll quickly go through it. So on slide number two, I described the 5 points. The first point is that the dose metrics that I've proposed, CTDI, DLP, effective dose, very closely reflect the doses that patients actually absorb, and thus they're the right measures to use for a measure of quality. The second point are that the measures that I have used, I got the sense from the discussion that these measures weren't ready for prime time yet, and I want to highlight that these have been used for many years, over a decade, in many quality control programs focused on CT, and so not only are they ready for prime time, they've been validated, they've been tested, they're easy to collect, and so I think they're the right thing to do now. The third point is that these measures are highly relevant even without consideration of patient weight, and I think that was a key concern. Four, I just want to highlight a few comments of people who are really leaders in this area, including a past president of the AAPM, who have looked at the measure. They're actually involved in the development of the measure, and so I think there has been a lot of support, and I'm sorry I couldn't share that on the call. And then last, practical examples of how this information could be used. So going to slide number three, I have personally collected these measures across 12 large institutions. My work describing two of these measures, DLP and effective dose, across 4 hospitals in the San Francisco Bay Area were published in the Archives of Internal Medicine in 2009. A large study that we're nearly complete with, we're getting ready to publish it, was conducted across 8 large integrated healthcare systems where we collected all of these parameters in thousands of patients. And some of the numbers I'm showing you, we collected these dose metrics among thousands of patients of different ages. I collaborate with an investigator at the National Cancer Institute named Chun-Sik Lee, who was kind enough last week to basically calculate very detailed numbers of organ doses, so not just these parameters, but to show you the relationship between organ doses. And so the numbers of organ doses are in 1,000 patients I'm going to share. So next slide, slide number 4. So my first point is that the metrics closely reflect organ doses. Basically, the dose parameters that I'm specifying reflect the doses that a patient's exposed to. A patient goes into the scanner. I'm on slide number 4, Andrew. So the dose that the patient's exposed to when they're in the scanner, they dictate the doses that that patient's going to absorb. If the patient's exposed to a high dose, they're going to absorb a lot of dose in the liver. These absorbed doses will vary subtly by weight and sex, but they're primarily determined by the doses that come out of the machine. So if you have a little bit of dose out of the machine, the patient's going to get a little bit of dose, and vice versa if it's a big dose. Big dose means a lot of harm. So on the next slide, slide number 5, I'm just showing you for one calculation. Looking at abdominal CT. Abdominal CT is by far the most common CT we perform in the U.S., and you can calculate 10 different organ doses in the abdomen. You can calculate the dose to the colon, to the liver, to the gallbladder, to the stomach. They all come out about the same if you're talking about a close region. On this slide, I'm showing you absorbed colon dose versus one of the measures of CTDI, and they're highly correlated. So some people were concerned that these measures don't reflect what happens to the patient, but in fact, the correlations are very high, and they closely reflect what happens to the patient. On the next slide, slide number 6, I'm showing the association between the absorbed colon dose and the effective dose. The correlation is 0.95. So if you know the dose that's coming out of the machine, you have a pretty close sense of what's happening to the patient. So that was my first point, that the doses that we're suggesting be used are ones that matter. The second question, the topic that I thought is worth just mentioning, is that these metrics have been collected for many years, so I'm not suggesting new measures that haven't been validated. The FDA has collected CTDI, one of the 3 measures that I'm suggesting, in a national survey that they've collaborated with state radiation protection workers for many years. Most recently, they collected CT dose information using CTDI in 2005, and it's what these measures were developed to do, to allow comparison of dose across platforms. In Europe, many countries collect these dose indices on every single patient who undergoes a CT. And I've sent references for two of them, one published by the UK program and one published by the Spanish program. I've given you the reference here, and I've sent the papers to Andrew. And they show these measurements have not only been feasible, but they've also led, by collecting these measures, to dramatic declines in doses. It basically increases dose awareness, it helps facilities understand the doses they're using, and as a result, the doses in these countries are much lower than they are in the U.S. So these measures have been found reliable. Slide number 8 addresses the issues raised by, I think, Cynthia McCullough and Mike McNick-Gray, are that if you don't look at patient weight, these measures are useless. And in general, just a little background, it takes more radiation dose to penetrate a very large patient than a very small patient. If you have a small child in the scanner, you don't have to put as much radiation in to get good pictures as you might if you have a really obese adult. In adults, if you're talking about patients in sort of the normal size category, doses can actually vary by 50%, by 100%, by 200% between actually the extremes of weight. So I'm not saying that weight doesn't matter. It does matter. And there have been many papers on this, but one of them was written by Israel, published recently. Jim Brink co-authored that paper. But doses unrelated to patient size can vary tenfold, 20-fold, or 100-fold. So the order of magnitude difference, the big picture, has nothing to do with weight. So weight differences matter when you're trying to calculate organ dose, but not nearly as much as the variation that has nothing to do with weight. And so, unfortunately, there's no easy way to take into account weight. There are no easy ways to convert dose into weight, and it makes it impossible to calculate any measures because weight is simply not available within the radiology data. We don't collect that information in radiology, and thus if you require the level of precision to get a perfect estimate of dose based on weight, you have no measure available. So going to the next slide, I just want to highlight some different sources of information on the variation that you might get due to factors that have nothing to do with weight. This is a table from our Archives of Internal Medicine paper, and it shows for a routine head scan, that's the first row of data, this is a routine head scan, doses, the mean doses between site 1, 2, 3, and 4 varied, and the variation between patients varied 20 times for the exact same study. Meaning the patient was sent for one reason, and depending on where the patient went, one facility may use one dose, another 20-fold higher, and that had very little to do with weight. If we look at the next slide, slide number 10, this is also showing data from the Archives of Internal Medicine. Each of those different box plots is showing the dose for one type of study. So these are all patients who were sent for the same type of study. That red line to the right aspect of this graph is showing the dose that we usually say occurs with an abdominal CT scan. The box plots with those blue crosses are showing the actual distribution in dose. And so you might get a 50% difference in dose due to weight, at least in our data, but we actually observed a tenfold difference in weight due to different protocols. And so that had nothing to do with difference in weight. If I go to the next slide, slide 11, this is from our HMO research paper. We're sending it in now to be published. This is looking at really small strata of age. So that red box is highlighting patients who were 1 to 4 years old who had a particular type of abdominal CT done. The mean dose for that is the third row and that the third column. The mean dose was 23 millisieverts, which is a pretty high dose for a one-year-old. It's a very high dose. But the range in dose, the minimum. Hello? Hello?
Please continue.
Am I still on?
We can hear you.
Okay.
Yeah, we can hear you.
I apologize. So the minimum dose went from 5 to 136, and these are all children of about the same weight. So those differences had nothing to do with it. And then the last slide on this area is just showing the doses from the American College of Radiology Dose Registry. These were shared by Rick Morin. He was the measure developer for the other measure on CT radiation dose. The average CTDI vol, the third column is 32, but the range was 7 to 245. And again, the CTDI-Vol should be around 20. The median was 32, so 50% higher was the median, and the range was profoundly broader. And so what we're trying to do is get the doses in a normal range, and we're not trying to focus so much on the small one. This last slide on the variation in dose by patient weight is a complicated slide. I don't have a lot of time to explain it, but this is looking at the differences in absorbed dose between newborns. They're usually about 8 pounds, and 10-year-olds are about 80 pounds, and the differences are between the blue and the purple line. And this is showing that the difference due to patient weight has to do the difference in each of these organ system absorbed doses of about 50%. So there's a small difference between the different absorbed weights, and this is a tenfold difference in weight. We don't get anything like that in adult patients. We get much smaller. There's still not that big of a difference in the kind of doses that you use. So I'm trying to highlight, next slide, Andrew, where those arrows are, that there is, next slide, there is a difference between a small person and a large person, but that's relatively modest compared to the hundredfold default we see. And so our measure clearly calls for collection of patient dose indices within size strata in terms of children, so there's no risk of mixing children and adult numbers. But among adult patients, the differences in adults' size will average at the facility level, and so it will not in any way affect this being a valid measure. And none of the countries that use these measures adjust for patient size. I'm almost at the end. Slide number 16, and the next few slides, I'm just highlighting a couple of comments of people who have written letters of support for the measure. Rick Morin, who I measured, is former president and chair of the board of the American Association of Physicists in Medicine. He's current chair of the ACR Commission on Medical Physics and chair of the ACR Dose Index Registry, strongly endorses the measure as written. He highlights that there's much higher than acceptable variation in the dose indices associated with CT. There's no program where data are collected from actual scans and no simple metrics for facilities to know how they're doing. And he believes the adoption of this metric would immediately provide guidance for radiology facilities to collect dose index information to understand how their doses compare with optimal performance standards. Next slide. Jerry Bush.
Rebecca, this is Lisa. Just noting the time frame.
Okay.
I would encourage you to move along through the comments here, because I believe that the steering committee members will have seen these.
Okay. Perfect. I'll just point out that Jerry Bushberg wrote one, says he understands it doesn't adjust for patient size, but still valid. The next slide, Jeff Schurin believes that this is a great place to start. He runs the Center for Devices and Radiologic Health at the FDA. And then the last topic is just that these metrics can rapidly be used for quality control programs. So we're using these measures as a way to assess radiology technologist performance. And the way to do that, next slide, is we're basically comparing the frequency distribution for each technologist. In this slide, I'm showing that the allowable limit in the UK is 20, and this technologist has doses for most of the scans that are higher than that. So it's a way to bring this technologist into the norm. And then we have generated an audit report, last slide, that basically shows technologists how they're doing. So the top line is how this technologist does in these three dose indices, CTDI, DLP, and effective dose, and they're compared to two broad comparison groups to other hospitals that Ames have whited out. On the left, the CTDI index of this technologist is compared to the ACR threshold, and the technologist is in the norm but is much higher than recommended. So that was the end of my quick summary. On slide 22, the last slide, I just say that I think the metrics are relevant. I think they've been tested and are reliable. Patient weight is not terribly important. The metric has garnered strong support, and I think an audit program where facilities basically share their data, are given feedback of their performance, and then are using these data to generate national cutoffs would go a long way to leading to improved performance. CMS is particularly interested in facilities participating in an audit program because that provides a way that they can basically get rewarded for doing a good job for dosing. So I appreciate the chance to present this. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Smithman, and we appreciate you, presenting this material as well. At this time, I'd like to ask Dr. Paul Nagy to speak to the steering committee's previous comments, summarizing our last conversations.
Thank you. I do have some things I've put together. I've gone back to the original metrics we looked at, in terms of importance, and I really couldn't agree more with Dr. Smith-Beinman that this is a very important metric. We've seen, as of even in 2008, with the reported overdosing of 260 patients with undergoing brain perfusion studies, receiving eight times their prescribed dose, having hair loss, and being at increased risk for cataracts and cancer, we've seen this really happening in more and more sites throughout the U.S., showing the real gap in performance in being able to do that. I concur with her that the CTDI volume, the CT dose index, is a very well-defined metric. All the manufacturers of CT makers recognize it. The physics community also recognizes it and recommends it as the best metric to measure the dose indices to patients. And I look back, at our scientific validity, and I agree that it's a repeatable metric, and it's well-defined. One of the challenges it runs into is reproducibility, in that the problem is that there's a confounding factor when translating the dose index into lifetime attributable risk. And this is the objections raised by the American College of Radiology and the American Association of Physicists and Medicine. To calculate the lifetime attributable risk, it really depends upon the organ dose because they are the biologically sensitive areas of the body. The example that the AAPM used was having two patients, with one patient being significantly obese and the second patient being normal. The first patient may require twice the dose or CTDI volume exposure to maintain the same image quality of the inner structures of the body for diagnosis compared to the second patient. And from receiving twice the CTDI, they might assume they might be at twice the risk, but in reality they are really at the same risk because of all the dose being absorbed by the relatively low biological sensitive adipose areas of the body. And so I think the core objection was that this metric, when reported in the report, to remind the committee, in the Radiation Systemic Registry, the ACR actually recommends the same metric to be reported to a national registry for performance improvement. Their objection is that in putting it into the radiologist's final report, is this may be misunderstood by patients and create confusion and misinterpretation due to the relative risk because of the variability due to the body habitat. And so the question I have gotten to is what I was grappling with, and I think we're all grappling with as a committee, is what is the potential impact upon referring physicians and patients in handling this extra information on the radiology reports? I was hoping Dr. Rick Morin, is he still on the line?
Operator, could we open the line for Dr. Morin? I believe he may be on.
Yes, sir. Just a moment. And Dr. Morin's line is open at this time.
Good. Yes, I am here, Paul.
Thank you, Rick. So, Dr. Morin, if you wouldn't mind commenting on the above metric, I would appreciate it, especially on the potential impact upon referring physicians and patients in handling this information in their reports.
The part that's difficult is how does the referring physician know what that metric was? Because the report goes to the referring physician and in some cases now to the patients. For the patients, it's going to be very confusing because it is a dose index that's being reported out. It's not a patient dose. It's not an organ dose, and it's really not an effective dose. The fact that you can calculate a number from it using some equations that some people will use and some people would disagree, that doesn't make it an effective dose. Secondly, the effective dose by by definition, was never meant to be used for individual patients. It was meant to be used as a radiation protection tool for populations. And so hence, the ICRP who created it has already gone on record several times saying that this should not be used for individual doses. So the patients are stuck with a number that then what would they do with that? They would most likely call somebody or worse, go to the Internet. And if they go to the Internet, it will not be very clear to them if they don't have backgrounds in medical physics or radiation protection. It will not be clear at all what this number means. And, in fact, the misinterpretation could lead them to turning down exams next time that an exam was suggested because they were inadvertently informed by sources on the Internet. So that does present a primary issue. The reason it's very important, therefore, to understand that these are dose indices. What they really do is tell you something about the output of the scanner. And they can certainly be used very well in the comparison comparisons that were presented in saying that our dose index is five times higher than someplace else. Why is that? And maybe it's because some of the acquisition techniques are just set up too high. In that case, it fits very well for things like PQRS and MOC Part 4 and things like that, because it clearly could enhance the performance of the practice. The issue for the referring physicians is being handled right now in a different way. Rather than getting the information back after the study is done, it's being pushed to have decision support on the front end that would score it by some sort of appropriateness criteria or something like that. The reason for that is that even if it's in the report, I mean, I think it's very common knowledge that all physicians don't read all reports that closely. In fact, many physicians would rather just have at the very front, at the very beginning, negative study or positive study, and then suggestions what else to do, perhaps. But so having a number in the report that then the referring physician would have to keep a tally of that somehow, and thereby periodically look and see what their numbers were compared to others, is a very tedious and difficult task, particularly in private practice. It would be difficult enough in academic centers where there's a different motivation, but in private practice, it would be very, very hard to do.
Thank you. So I also wanted to talk to, I have a question for Dr. Paul Straczynski, who is an ED physician and a consumer of radiology. So what impact do you think it would have on your practice to have radiation dose in your radiology reports?
Well, we were, you know, it's interesting because our institution is grappling with the issue of tracking patients who've had, an extensive history of radiation utilization through imaging. We have recurrent ED patients. We see about 160,000 patients a year at our two EDs. And although this entire process has been extremely educating for me, I can tell you that as with private ED physicians and academic ED physicians, the vast majority of academic ED physicians would have, other than being able to say millisievers, their recognition, understanding of exposure and utilization is fairly limited. There is no doubt that a number that is an indice that looks at the output and performance of the actual system could easily be confused with the actual dosing that a patient received. The reality is that we wouldn't really know what to do with it. That's not saying that an education couldn't occur, but it's fairly difficult enough during, an encounter just discussing with a patient what the pathology is and trying to boil that down into a layman term to then have an additional number that really is related to the performance of the product and those individuals who essentially function the product, the CT imager, will be difficult. And in an ED setting, you know, when we often have to make decisions fairly quickly, and the public is certainly getting increased awareness through the general media about the fact that overutilization occurs, dosing issues occur. I'm not even sure the vast majority of them recognize right now that that there's a great variation in potential dose exposure or these other metrics. It could play havoc. I understand that this is something that has been reported, it has been recommended to be reporting, but the pathway of driving it on to the consuming practitioner and therefore the patient, I think, is where everyone's going to have some issues. So I can tell you that this would add an additional level of complexity to explain that. I understand the value of it from the standpoint of trying to stratify performance to decrease variance and to bring people in line, but from a practitioner standpoint, it will be extremely difficult.
So, thank you. I also had one question for Dr. Smith-Binman, in that I believe this is now state law in California, so I was wondering if she had any experiences for how this might be impacting referring physicians or patients. There seemed to be a lot of concern from the American College of Radiology and the American Association of Physicists and Medicine this is going to cause difficulty.
I think my line wasn't connected, but I'd also like to say something in response. But the California law takes effect in 2012, and every facility in the state is scrambling to figure out how we're going to get this information into the medical record. And the way it gets into the medical record, I'm a little overwhelmed at how paternalistic the comments are that patients can't handle this information and referring physicians can't handle this information. There are lots of ways to share this information that would be very easily understood. For example, the doses for a facility are within the normal range or are 10 times higher than the normal range. Everyone would get that as being a way to help patients understand it. We've also collected the information across 12 large institutions, and every single one of those institutions is profoundly changing their performance, changing the way they protocol the patients, because we've helped them look at their data. And that's what this measure would do. The data also do not only reflect what comes out of the machine, it reflects what goes into the patient. So with all due respect, to say that these don't reflect the doses to the patient, they're pretty darn close, as I showed in all my figures, to what the patient gets. So in the state of California in 2012, this information has to be put into every patient's medical record, although the state doesn't require facilities to look at these data. So the step where facilities have it is missing. And the last thing I just want to say is I did not appreciate that the problem is with putting the data in the medical record. If the committee would be willing, I'd be happy to get rid of that second part of the measure. I care about facilities starting to look at this measure, and if this would be endorsed as facilities looking at it but not putting it into the medical record, I think that could be a really big step. I think it's better to put it in the medical record, but if there was willingness to endorse part of it, part A of the measure, then I think that would be by itself a really good quality step forward.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Dr. Nagy, was that you?
That was me.
Okay. Go ahead. Sorry.
I thought about that, and I had some questions about that. So you're right. So the question is, what if we don't include this in the final report? It technically is recorded in the PACS, which is technically part of the electronic medical record, although it's really far less accessible and not very transparent to the public. And the question is that today almost everybody does that. And so would that mean that they're complying to this metric?
There's a lot of discussion across the state, and it's generally, when you read the state rule, it says that the physician has to be, the ordering physician basically has to be able to read the dose information. And since the physician in many places can't see the PACS, what Paul is referring to is that there's often a picture of the dose that's one of the images next to a CT scan, the dose report. Some facilities have this function off, but potentially it could be stored with the pictures, but unless the referring physician has access to this information, it's not deemed to comply with the intention or the letter of the law. So most facilities, I work a lot with the Kaisers. I'm putting in a grant across the UCs to try to deal with our response will be to get this information in the medical record. And I think the way I'm thinking it can go in the medical record, the number needs to be interpreted, right? You never have a meaning of a risk factor for disease. You need lots of information that has to be explained to the patient. And I think this is it's time for us to do it with this. There's nothing in this measure that says anything about lifetime attributable risk of cancer. And so I'm surprised that there's criticism of this measure based on the imperfection of the lifetime attributable risk. I mean, we don't know exactly how harmful it is, but I will say that there's no one who has any data to support that a large patient who has a large dose of radiation is at lower risk of a small patient who has a large dose of radiation. We don't know that. And so this just says, let's look at our doses and try to keep them within some defined range when now they might be 100-fold higher than they should be. And so this is just a first step to try to bring in these profound and unsafe doses.
And
this is Lisa. I'd like to to ask you a follow-up question concerning the required or perceived needs of education on this measure. And would you be able to, knowing that you've worked with multiple facilities and have seen multiple implementations across various facilities, would you be able to speak to, from your perspective and experience in working with these groups, the level of education that was needed in order to interpret this information once it is placed in the medical chart? Do you have a more detailed exemplar that you could give us?
If you can put up, Andrew, the technologist audit report that I sent you, as part of funding that we got from one of the facilities that I work with, is the intervention to basically give feedback to the technologist. And I will say, for full disclosure, our feedback and the teaching that we're doing to these technologists is being done by Dr. Morin. So Dr. Morin and I are flying to this facility. The technologists, you know, different audience, are being educated at what these measures mean. And then if you could slide down, Andrew, on the second page, they're being told this is what these measures mean, and this is how we're going to give you feedback. They're comparing their doses. So this is a technologist. For the referring physician, it hasn't been so different. We've been putting the dose information in the medical records at UCSF over the last year. We started by giving the feedback to the emergency room physicians, and we've sort of explained to them what these measures mean and why we use high doses, why we use low doses. But by the way, we've gotten rid of our really high doses. We had protocols we were using routinely that we no longer use because the doses were too high. And instead of getting the feedback that I'm hearing people being concerned about, patients coming, calling with a state of panic, why is my number so high, we get tons of calls of what's the dose? Why is it in the medical record? Why can't I find my dose? How are the doses at UC compared to other places? How are my doses compared to other people? So we're getting a real demand for this information rather than a sense of fear. At the individual level, it is possible that a patient will say, I am afraid of the radiation dose. I don't want to get a scan. And we're currently probably doing about 30% more CTs than we need to. So of the 75 million CTs that we're doing, maybe we don't need to do 25 million of them. Will there be a few patients who do need them and don't get them? Yes, there will. There undoubtedly will be some of those patients. But I think we've gone so far the other way of imaging all the time when we don't need to, that we need to strike a balance. And I think this information, at least to me as a parent, is really important when I decide to scan my kids. I think other parents out there, other wives, sisters, brothers, are entitled to the same information. So we have been educating physicians. I speak to quite a lot of patients who email me most days to ask about it, and I just have conversations and explain their numbers. And this is a randomized trial where we're educating techs, and we're going to try to see if we can lower their doses.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Being respectful of time, it's approximately 3:12 Central, so 4:12 Eastern. And I know we have approximately 15 to 17 minutes left scheduled on this call. Dr. Nagy, I think you, did you have additional questions?
I have two more questions, and then I'll try to respect the other voices on our committee. The one question I had was, if we recommended just Part A, I think we would have to really consider harmonization with the systemic registry, because it becomes very similar in process. The other idea I had...
Wait, Paul, can you just explain that? Because there's no data collected or reported for the other measure. So how would you...
Well, in terms of, I agree with you that the big problem we're having in CT dose is in protocol variation, which is the registry's main goal is automatically uploading that information to be able to provide you benchmarking information to see how that changes your behavior. And it seems similar but not localized for how you do the data collection and how you do the analysis based on a histogram to see the identify the outliers and then be able to get information to see how you can improve upon that. And so in terms of, you know, if you're not including this in the final report, it seemed to have a little bit more overlap with the measure 43. I did have one idea I'd like you to consider to see what you thought about. I thought that if we could narrow the focus of this instead of all CTs to perhaps just CTs of the head, in that it addresses the major body habitus concerns raised by the ACR and the APM about their concerns about the reliability or reproducibility of the metric. It also is where we're seeing a lot more identification of medical errors today in the U.S. as well. You know, do you think that would be too much of a constraint on this measure? Because I think in that sense, you don't have the variation you have in other body parts.
I would, if you chose to do that, you would basically, as far as I'm concerned, remove all value of the measure. Mm-hmm. So. CTDI, it's a much longer discussion, but there's much more consistency in head measurements in terms of dosing, except for the CT perfusion scan. The doses in the CT of the head might be a 50th or a 100th of what the doses are in the abdomen. The risk for having harm from those doses, because the brain is much less sensitive to cancer than the chest or the abdominal organs, is much less. There's much less association between the brain measurements. I think it would be, it would basically take out any value of the measure. I think where you want to use this measure is in the area where the variation is a 100-fold difference between different facilities, and that's primarily in the abdomen, where the harm is so great, and where the tendency is to basically over-radiate dose. So I think the key to having a quality measure work is to look at all your doses and look at the important high doses and bring those down. I think the huge difference between the CT dose registry is they're not providing any information. They're not setting any standards in a public fashion. There are currently 10 facilities, 10 machines in the country that are connected, as opposed to having 10,000 machines collect their dose information instantly. And so I think the real money where you get the value is in the abdomen and chest, and that's where they've been doing this for many years in Europe, and their doses are much, much lower than ours. So, yes, I would be very unhappy with taking away the abdomen and the chest. I think that's where you need the measure.
Okay, and lastly, you mentioned that it was difficult to or impractical to record the weight along with the CTI volume, yet most technologists are going to be asking the patient their weight or being able to get that measure from somewhere. Why do you feel that's a difficult component to add into that calculation?
The measure, I think there are two reasons. The measure as currently written could be calculated by most facilities in a day. It would take a few hours to record all the information that's called for. To record weight requires facilities to change their practice, and that's an enormous change in what they do. You could find that information in the medical record, We've done it in 5,000 patients across our integrated healthcare systems, and it was a lot of work. And so to get the information for an auditor would be very hard, if not impossible. Outpatient facilities don't have any records. Technologists don't record the weight. So I think feasibility, it wouldn't be possible to do it. But second, it's not necessary to record the weight. The measures, as I showed you in these slides, is highly correlated with organ dose, and those calculations all take into account patient weight. So it doesn't really matter that much. It feels to me like a distraction. And then what you end up with is a number that's so much harder to interpret. So then how many weight categories do we come up with? I think that it will only matter for facilities that treat obese patients as their only patients. Otherwise, the difference in weight are going to average out across facilities. There's no reason two facilities across the street from each other would have such different weight populations. And even if they did, their doses would be 50% or 100% difference, and we're looking for differences that are 10 or 20-fold. We're looking for outliers. And I think within our facilities, we have really shifted their dosing within the course of a year by letting them know how they're doing. And that's all this measure is trying to do.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Smith-Binman. This is Lisa. Dr. Nagia, if my count's correct, that was those were your questions?
Yes.
Is that okay? Great.
Thank you.
And I wanted to thank everybody thus far. Do we have any other questions for Dr. Smith-Binman from the rest of the steering committee members at this point?
Yes, Alan Levine. I have, if I make one point, I have a question. The FDA put out a white paper on this issue, and one of the points they make, just for the steering committee's edification, is what the point three in the white paper: increase patient awareness, provide patients with tools to track their personal and medical imaging history. So FDA is endorsing one of the questions we've raised in terms of the degree to which patients that have this information. I do have a question about machine variability and whether it is significant. So I guess the newer machines maybe have more accurate dosage information in terms of the metrics that appear. And to what extent is that an important variable in terms of accurate dose measurement, in terms of the nature of the machine, the age of the machine, et cetera?
There are a whole bunch of parts to your question that I could answer. In terms of whether the data that I'm proposing, CTGI, are available, based on the FDA survey from 2005, greater than 95% of the machines had the metrics out there. So CTI was available on the machine on 95% of machines, and now it's thought to be higher than 98% of machines. So the metrics there on all machines. In terms of the validity of the measure, is it measuring the same thing? There are subtle differences between the different machines in how it calculates these measures. But the differences we're talking about are relatively small, a few percentage points. So a CTGI means almost exactly the same thing on different machines, but very slight differences. The third part of your question is the larger issue, which is that the doses have gone down or will go down if the manufacturer starts selling different products that lower the dose. So they can lower the dose during an exam, and so newer scanners will have lower doses than older scanners, and hopefully that will become more dramatic. And that's the reason that the dose metric as specified requires recording the type of scan, type of machine and the model that you're using. So if you have people participate in a dose audit program, they would send in their doses, but they would do it within the machine. So you wouldn't compare a 2011 machine doing its best to a 2005 machine doing its best, but you would want a 2005 machine to do as well as other 2005 machines. So the measurement is still valid, but we don't expect things to stay stagnant over time. It's changing and hopefully improving over time. And this is a way for a facility to know whether their dosing is okay or whether, in fact, they can't get the dosing they want and maybe it's time to consider new software or new machine.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Any further questions from the steering committee members?
Yeah. Steve Lawless, I have a quick question. It seemed very intense with what you were taking the data, and you were very effective in your conversations with providers in terms of lowering variability. How much variability was lowered because you had that direct contact with them versus just them knowing the dosages?
I would say, you mean how much was me trying to convince them versus them looking at their own data?
Right. If this is becoming national, we're not going to be able to hire you for every hospital across the country.
Well, no, I'm available. I travel well. So I think the truth is their own awareness has been the largest driving force. So I can tell you at my institution, when I published a paper in Archives of Internal Medicine, it turned out that we have a full-time physicist on UC faculty whose job it is to measure dose. But the way he had been measuring dose was using phantoms rather than looking at doses in real patients. And that's typically how CT scans are evaluated. We do a protocol on a dummy, a very sophisticated, expensive plastic dummy, and that's how we know what we're doing. And the doses in real patients were much, 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 much higher and were variable. And so allowing them to see their own doses without my really saying very much at all allowed them to realize after the shock of seeing the numbers was, oh, wait a minute, there are all these things that we're doing in clinical practice that we don't do when we test the phantom. So the institutions that I'm talking about have radiation safety committees put in place and are reviewing their protocols, and that has nothing to do with me. So I am really pushing for work to standardize protocols more quickly, but it's just the facilities seeing their own variation that's led to some of the changes that we've seen. And that has been, there's these extra protocols that we're using often were adopted without any validity of that they help you, but they sometimes provide more beautiful pictures. And radiologists really like beautiful pictures, and they didn't appreciate the cost that those pictures were coming with in terms of higher dose. And so once they saw that, they didn't need me to say, is this really necessary? So no, I don't think it is me. I also told you on the last call that I'm creating a UC audit program where people will send us their dose information if you guys adopt the measure. We will provide them individual feedback and audit information and then use their data anonymously to create these diagnostic reference levels, and then facilities can see what proportion are above threshold and how they vary. And so that would be the feedback process where they would learn to understand their own dose in the context of other national performance parameters that we create.
And Dr. Smith-Binman, this is Lisa again. The audit program that you're suggesting, however, was almost, and was from a steering committee perspective, was almost like a third arm to the original measure. And so the steering committee at this point was not considering the audit component to, the added audit component to the original measure. Do we have any other steering committee member comments or questions for Dr. Smith-Binman?
Yeah, this is Alan Levine again. I'm just curious whether, in your own experiences with in California, whether you've had any cost studies on this in terms of the impact one way or the other, in terms of, you know, the implementation costs versus reduction in, you know, exposure savings, et cetera?
There haven't been any cost studies at all. The way the bill is worded is that very small rural facilities who couldn't do this, you know, basically because of cost considerations, wouldn't have to. But there haven't been any studies, and the belief is that nothing is really required except another piece of documentation. And so there will be cost implications for facilities to get the actual data into the medical record, but it's thought to be very small. And so I'm surprised there haven't been any cost studies of it, but there have not.
Any additional comments or questions from steering committee members? Okay. So at this point, I believe we are approximately 17 minutes after, 12 minutes or so, about opening up for public comments concerning this, and then we will circle back and, from a steering committee perspective, see if we have any additional follow-up comments or questions after public comments, and then take a straw vote from the steering committee. So, operator, would you open the line for public comments?
Very well. All lines are open at this time.
Hi, this is Cynthia McCullough. Can folks hear me?
We can.
All right. Thank you for a chance for us to make some additional comments. I am the chairman with Dr. McNick Gray, who I believe is also on the call, of the APM CT subcommittee on, CT subcommittee, as well as numerous dose task groups, and so including the international groups on dose. And we are extremely passionate. We spend, it's probably our highest priority of activities about dose management, which includes dose reporting and then education on interpreting those dose numbers. The ImageGently campaign was passionate about making sure that the dose numbers, these indices on the scanner, meant something for the kids. And they came to the APM in July very much wanting something, and we have, between July and now, put out a task group report, which is going for its final stages of review any day now, that we've come up with a consensus way to take these dose indices and, with knowledge of the patient size, come up with a mean dose in the center of the scan volume that is an apple-to-apple that we can compare. Included in the task group report is a recommendation to the manufacturers on how the scanner can just look at the image and add up the attenuation and pixel values and automatically do the patient size. We've already got manufacturers' buy-in on this. And so we have been very active and responsive in trying to get a handle not just on what the scanner's doing, which is what CTDI is, but on what that means for the patient. And so this measure and these metrics are simply too early. There is we're on the verge of doing the right thing about these numbers, and in our quest to make sure the dose is being managed well, we are very opposed to putting out the wrong dose metrics. I had a patient call me today, third time cancer recurrence, who snuck into her PET CT scan wearing some Instadose meter that she bought over the internet, and now they're calling me saying, it's at 8,000 millirem. How many cancers am I going to get from this? These numbers, as we're all learning from the Japan coverage, I've been spent 20 years as a radiation physicist. It's not straightforward that we can just give simple brochures to patients and have this be meaningful. The numbers that Dr. Smith-Feinman are talking about, I've seen the dose registry. I've done dose surveys. I've looked at the European numbers. And quite honestly, the scanners cannot do a factor of 100 variation. Those numbers are coming from dose reports that maybe add up everything. It's not sorted out properly yet. And so there are numbers out there that just don't make sense. And so building a registry of inaccurate information is not in the best service of patients or anyone. I'm going to let Mike have a chance to speak, but before I do that, I have to strongly endorse and request that effective dose, no matter what other decision is made today, that effective dose absolutely be taken out as a metric. The ICRP verbatim says effective dose is calculated for a reference person, which is a mathematical model, and not for an individual. And they, throughout their report, over and over and over, say effective dose should never be applied to an individual. And as Dr. Morin said, you can take numbers off the scanner and throw them into an equation, but it's wrong. And we have a very big problem with those numbers being used as they're being used. So I'm going to stop and let Dr. McNick Gray chime in. So I'm happy to answer any questions that he might want to come back with.
Dr. McRae, before you speak, I just need to do a time check with our NQF staff. This call was scheduled for 4:30. And so do we have the ability to go much past this or not, Elisa or Andrew?
We're fine with it as long as the committee's fine and people don't have to leave, but I would say continue the discussion.
Okay. Let me check in with the steering committee members. I know some people did have hard stops shortly after 4:30 Eastern time, so I'm thinking that we probably still need to identify how many people we have on the call in order to make sure that we have a quorum here. Elise, could we do a quick roll call?
Sure. Dr. Conway.
This is Heidi. I think at this point I just would rather, if Lisa and Bill, if you're okay, let's just have the public comment, get out all the public comments, and then we'll do everything by email to follow.
Okay. Sounds
that
great. Thanks, Heidi.
Okay.
Thanks, Heidi. Okay. Dr. McGray?
My name is Mike McNitt-Gray. I'm from UCLA and with Cynthia McCullough. I'm the co-chair of the APM subcommittee for CT. I think I just have a few comments. I'll be brief. I think it should be made clear that we in the APM and the ACR groups, I'm involved with both, we really share the same goals of this measure, which is that we want people to use CT appropriately. We want the dose to be used appropriately, and we want to eliminate those exams that use an excessive amount of dose. And I think our issues really are in the details of the proposal and the use of these metrics. And as you've heard, you saw some arguments earlier that size is not a large component. I think my own work and those of my colleagues has shown that it's a factor of two difference at least, from small to large patients, and probably larger difference than that. So maybe that's not a big, very significant range for the kinds of things you're looking for, but to us that seems like a big number. So that's one factor, is that the size does make a difference by a factor of two. And what I mean by that is for the same CTDI, patients can absorb somewhere between 2.5 to 3 times different amounts of dose depending on their size alone. And the scanner would give the same CTDI reading. Another thing about the standardization is that specifically with kids, there is some, I don't want to say disagreement, but there's some inconsistency between manufacturers right at the moment as to which size phantom they report the dose to. Some use a 16-centimeter phantom, some use a 32-centimeter phantom, and the important thing there isn't the size of the phantom, it's that the values that you get out of the scanner when you change the size of the phantom also vary by a factor of about 2, actually about 2.5. So if you don't do anything else but you compare GE scanners to Siemens scanners, you get this factor of 2.5 difference for pediatric patients, not based on the dose to the patient but based on the reporting that they do to the different phantoms. And the third thing that I want to mention was that I'm also involved in the ACR Dose Index Registry, and Rick Morin and I have been through this, and as well as his staff, that when you have an exam called abdomen pelvis, that encompasses a really broad range of things. Sometimes you're looking for something subtle, and you need a reasonable amount of dose to look for something subtle to get the noise down. Other times you're looking for something very obvious, and you don't need a lot of dose. And yet those still come under the same general category of abdomen pelvis. And so this is also a reason that you get this range of values under there. That doesn't explain a factor of 100. Some of that might be reporting. We don't know exactly because we haven't seen the data. And having sites look at their doses, I think, is a very important thing. I think the issue that we're really taking, that we're struggling with is trying to settle on this one metric as the thing to settle on and to standardize on, and to have it be the only focus of the report. Because of these factors, it's actually natural and very good practice to have variation, but it can be interpreted the other way. It can be that folks will say, well, no, I'm varying too much. I need to standardize, and my small patients and big patients should get the same, which is inappropriate practice. That's really one of the concerns that we have. And I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any other further public comments at this time?
Lisa, can I add something?
Is this Dr. Smith-Simon?
It is.
It is. Okay. Go ahead, please.
Many of the comments that Mike and Cynthia made are inconsistent with the measure as written. So the measure very explicitly explains that we're not comparing doses across manufacturers. It very explicitly says that the dose needs to be calculated within different size categories, so we wouldn't be comparing children to adults. And your endorsement of this measure has nothing in any way to do with stopping any of the development that they're doing to improve these measures. I think it's long past time that some measure is endorsed as a way to start this process. And if they come up with a measure that's better and that's easier to use, well, by all means, we should do it. The Image Gently campaign's a great idea, but there hasn't been a single study that's collected doses to show that it's had any impact on actual doses, except our work where we've collected thousands of doses to show the doses are not going down the way they're supposed to with the Image Gently campaign. So I think we explain in great detail in the measure why it's reasonable to have a single measure for abdominal scans. And if two facilities are in general having the same mix of patients, they should be good. If one facility chooses to do a high-dose quad-phase liver for every single patient, then their doses are going to be high, and that's a problem because they shouldn't be using that measure. So I think the measurement, the metrics as written, will give extraordinarily reliable indication of where there are problems and where there are not problems.
Thank you. Do we have additional public comments?
This is Dr. McCullough again. I would like to point out that the protocols, the scanner settings, themselves tell us if we, as a practice, are setting up our scanners correctly. I don't have to scan a single patient. I can pull up these protocols and see what my default settings are and compare those to one for a different body part or a different exam indication or the hospital down the street or the European reference values. The European practice of what they call these reference levels, where they go out and survey and do what Rebecca's suggesting, compare and look at distributions. If you read carefully their protocols for how you do that, they are for the standard size patient. They have a very narrow bracket of patient size that they do these reference levels for.
That's not true. They calculate actual data on actual patients. If they have really obese patients, they tell them not to include them in the data. But otherwise, they are almost 100% capture of real patients.
They are real patients from a band of, they have a specific height and weight group that if you are outside that, your data does not go into the dose survey. And if you look at the recent publications, and I'd like to say that the APM group here would like to follow up, since we don't have enough time on the call, with some references to provide some background for this. We didn't realize we could share anything further at this point. But the U.S. doses, the diagnostic reference levels that we've learned from the ACR program are consistent with all the European countries, because when you look at the UK, whose numbers look a little bit lower, you have to read the fine print. They're different exam indications. And so if there's any message in any of this, is that it's complex and we need to do it with a little more care than right now the measure is laid out.
Thank you for all the public comments. Do we have any additional comments at this time? Okay. Bringing operator, I'd request that we come back to the steering committee if possible. And any further questions from the steering committee members at this point?
Nope.
Not hearing any. Would the steering committee like to have further dialogue concerning PSM-044 at this time, or would you like to move to a straw vote as to where the steering committee stands?
I vote.
Okay. Thank you. So at this time, the steering committee is considering whether it will reverse its position concerning PSM-044. That is removal of endorsement of PSM-44 through the second draft.
from a straw vote perspective, does the steering committee feel that it will, it's their wish to reverse its opinion concerning PSM 044?
Yes.
Could you, this is Steve, could you just repeat again what, again, reversal?
Sure. What we're voting on?
Yeah.
During our February steering committee conference call, the steering committee made the decision to remove its recommendation for endorsement of PSM 044 as written at that time. That did not include a third component, a proposed third component. It was Part A and Part B of PSM 044. So, based on the conversations and additional information that you've received today concerning this measure, is it your decision that you would like to reverse your earlier decision to remove endorsement? So by saying yes, that would mean that you are going that you individually would recommend endorsing the PSM 044 as originally written.
Is there an option of also having another discussion about this, as much as I don't really want to do that? Someone's more comfortable just being able to talk internally before we make a final decision, or can we do that before the, can we do a straw vote and then talk afterwards and then do a final email vote?
Alisa?
Yeah, so what's going to happen after this is you're doing this straw vote to just kind of gauge where the committee is, and so we are preparing a meeting summary that we're hoping to get to you by tomorrow, so pretty fast. And we're also recording it. So the streaming of this, we've been assured by our meetings team that it will be available after this meeting. So we're going to send you all of this information and have the SurveyMonkey link for you to complete that in a few days. And so what might be helpful is in between that time, if you want to have an email exchange, because everyone will be on that email, all the steering committee, you can do so. We'll have a deadline for you for, I think it will be Friday of this week, because we go to vote on April 1st. And so we need to prepare the report with all the red line changes from today and from the February 22nd conference call that you had.
Lisa, this is Heidi. I'll just jump in for a second. Given the lateness of the hour, and it sounds like you may have some committee members reluctant to even
right.
do a straw vote at this point, why don't we carefully craft an email and a survey and just send it around, and then we'll let you have some time to think about it. If you have any additional questions, we're happy to work and get those answered for you. Does that seem reasonable?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. All right. So with that new information, it sounds like we're on to next steps really in some fashion, but I think we've already pretty well covered that. So Alisa and Andrew and Heidi, are you okay with us adjourning the meeting at this point? Then moving on to NQF staff will draft the discussed communications, share them with the steering committee. There's nothing that prevents the steering committee members from engaging in an email dialogue amongst ourselves concerning this discussion. And then we would look to do our final vote on this, on whether or not the steering committee is changing its opinion from its February 22nd conference call by the end of this week. Correct?
Yes.
Okay, great. All right. So with that in mind, I'd like to thank everyone on behalf of Dr. Conway and myself, all the steering committee members, as well as the public members, and Dr. Rebecca Smith-Finman for being on this call, sharing this additional information, and we'll look forward to hearing what the steering committee's decision is.
Yes, thank you to all of
you. Thank
you
very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation.